Welcome to the first full episode of the Boss Level Podcast. Boss Level is the status a person or an organization achieves by making a better quality of life for themselves and others by doing what they need to do, regardless of all the haters and obstacles out there. This first full episode that you're listening to now is an interview with Simon Marcus, Vice President of Operations at Spotify. I've now listened to the interview a couple of times myself, and I still find new things to learn from it. It's a lengthy talk, but I didn't want to take out any of the parts because it all felt so relevant and interesting. Simon is a smart guy, and I think that we can all learn a lot from him on our way to boss level. We discussed the concept of a minimum viable company, how Scrum and Kanban are a gateway drug, and who should do the thinking in organizations. Regarding Spotify, we cover the hierarchy in the company and how the chapters, tribes, and squads model is essentially just a matrix with fancy names. Without further ado, here's the interview. Well, hey, Simon, it's great to have you on the podcast.
It's great to be here.
So can you tell me a little about yourself?
Sure. When you told me that this is how we were going to start, my mind immediately went to Marc Maron and the way he runs his podcast.
Yeah,
and he's like very religious that you must start at the beginning.
Like, yeah.
He wants to hear like your birth story, and then he wants you to follow like this linear order perfectly. And if you get out of order,
he'll put you back.
Yeah. He'll say, we're going to get to that.
Yeah. But that's actually,
let's go back to the log cabin you were born in. Yeah. Let's start at the log cabin I was born in.
Yeah. We can do that. That's good.
Yeah. So I head up operations at Spotify, and I've been with Spotify for just about 2 years, actually, in a month. I think it'll be 2 years.
Okay. Yeah.
That's a piece of secret data. I keep it hidden from the people who run our weekly all-hands meeting. Because they make a big stink about your anniversaries, and I'm not a fan of
I don't
like that. Yeah. So I hope they don't hear this.
Or afterwards.
Yeah. Before that, I was at a 200-person company. I was chief operating officer of a 200-person privately held company called the Library Corporation. While there, just had the opportunity to apply, I think, a lot of unique thinking to the problems facing a 40-year-old company that had a tremendous amount of success in an increasingly difficult market and really needed to, in many ways, just sort of rethink itself and help an entire industry, the library industry, rethink itself.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was a lot of fun.
So I think Spotify is probably a brand that, like, all the listeners probably know, but can you tell a little more about like the TLC, the Library Corporation? What are the products or the things that you worked on with the company?
So the Library Corporation is one of the largest providers of library automation services. So, you know, think about when you go into a library and you want to see what material they have and you want to access the digital material or you want to check out physical material. They manage all of that. In many ways, it's just a big like resource tracking system, but then there are lots of ancillary components just around how you run the business of a library.
Okay.
Purchasing, pretty much everything you can think of. Either we built our own versions or we had relationships with other parties, for example, to do things like control access to computer systems or to video games, which are an increasingly important part of what libraries provide their communities, like the ability to just come in and play Xbox.
Yeah.
That was sort of the product space. When I got to the Library Corporation in 2007, I think it had a long, really great and rich history, and it had grown largely beginning in the south of the mm-hmm. United States, largely through small libraries, but had over time grown into helping to run some of the largest libraries in the world, Chicago Public, Los Angeles Public Library. And it had this sort of great, very down-home feel to it. And I think that lots of people really responded to that. You know, it created job opportunities for people who would have never gotten to work in knowledge work or a software company in a town in West Virginia, about an hour and a half from Washington, D.C. I think it was sort of an extraordinary opportunity to work with those people, many of whom had been there, probably the average tenure when I got there. I don't know exactly what it was, but well over 10 years, I would guess. And one of the things that happened there, which I think is very common, is that it had sort of been captured by its successes. So, you know, had many very long tenured customers and was largely focused on making sure that those customers remained happy. Yeah. And in many ways that took, took the eye off of growth. And you could see even in things like the physical setup of the company, the support department occupied a very large pit, sort of in the, at the center of the office space, and everything was sort of oriented towards that support group. I think when I got there, the founder and CEO could tell you sort of anything that was happening that day from a support perspective, but had much much less insight into what was happening around R&D.
Okay.
And there just hadn't been the pace or quality or innovation that you'd hope for coming out of R&D for a long time.
Yeah, and I think when I met you like 4 or 5 years ago for the first time, I think you gave me a card. You were still working at TLC at that time. And I think the card said something like, my 40-year-old company can pivot faster than your startup or something like that.
Yeah, that's what it said.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit more about that? Like what were the things that you started doing with the 40-year-old company?
Yeah. So I should give credit for that line where it belongs. I think that Jay Bloom, who was our CTO, came up with that line. It might have been Will Evans, who was our chief design officer, but I think it was Jay.
Okay.
I mean, to try to cover a lot of ground relatively quickly, I think the first thing that we did when we got there was just sort of realized that the organization needed to be reoriented towards being a product and engineering company from being just sort of a support and maintenance company. Mm-hmm. And the first thing we did actually was like really do a by the book Scrum implementation. And it's funny because the book that we used really was Henrik Nyberg's Scrum and XP from the Trenches. And,
oh, really?
And Henrik is now on my team at Spotify.
that's funny.
Which is awesome. And I get to tell him, like, you have no idea how much you influenced my life.
Wow.
Which is really cool.
Yeah.
We did like very by the book. Like we made everyone read the book and we were like, we're going to do it like this. And you know, this is a book where Henrik at the beginning is like, do not copy what it says in this book. so it's not his fault.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, actually I think in many ways that was super, useful for us. It's a strategy that I use much less often now, in my mature old age, but you know, sort of learning how to crawl before you can walk and walk before you can run, I think generally makes sense. And I think it served us reasonably well. Mm-hmm. I often talk about Scrum as a gateway drug. I think it's like, first of all, it just sort of got things flowing. And then we reached a point where, I started to be pretty frustrated with some of what we experienced and we went looking out for sort of what else is there. Jabe and I both started going to a lot of conferences and meeting a lot of people. And actually we sent someone else, a guy named DJ Miller, we sent him to, the Big Agile conference in maybe 2010, something like that.
Yeah. The big one in the US.
And he saw David Anderson talking about Kanban.
Yeah.
And he came back and he was like, we have to explore this thing. And I think both Jabe and I were like, just go away. No, we don't need another framework. But somehow, I don't remember if sort of DJ pushed us or it somehow we ended up, you know, really coming to start to explore Kanban.
Yeah.
And it sort of answered a lot of the problems that we had with Scrum. And at some point, we sort of gave everyone a quick Kanban training, and we sort of gave them a choice. Do you want, you can do Scrum, you can do Kanban, you can do Scrumban, you can do, you know, use this mix however you see fit. And like the next day, everyone had transitioned to a Kanban board.
That was quick, yeah.
Which was really interesting.
Yeah.
And then I think that Kanban, at least at that time, was itself a gateway drug to much bigger ideas.
Yeah.
So through the Kanban community, I was exposed to complexity theory and organizational psychology and systems thinking and the theory of constraints. And, you know, I also along the way learned that it's like less about adopting a particular framework and it's more about having these thinking models.
Yeah.
Some of which are, you know, in conflict with each other.
Yeah.
Systems thinkers and complexity theorists, you know, they can go at it.
And
I guess I'm a pretty linear thinker, so I struggled for a while about how can I like find something really useful in this framework and something really useful in this framework, most of which claim they're not frameworks, and how do I handle the complexity of that myself? But I'm past that now. Just like we have really big problems in knowledge work.
Yep.
I actually have a theory that the world is so complex right now that sort of historical management models just can't solve those problems. They can't organize us to figure out how to solve these problems. And I think that the lack of having access to the kinds of management models that could deal with the level of complexity there is in the world today is really why we're like building fart apps instead of solving the world's big problems.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping to try to help contribute to overcoming that.
Yeah. So you mentioned about the management problems that we have. What are the biggest management things that you see that are preventing us from doing the right things?
Yeah. So I mean, this isn't anything that lots of other people aren't saying, but I think when it comes down to it, it's really about who's doing the thinking in organizations. And it's about, you know, Spotify, for example, is I think today we're something like 1,700 people. And, you know, do we want to be a company in which, you know, there are five people doing most of the thinking or 20 people doing most of the thinking? Or do we want to be a company that can leverage the brain power of all 1,700 people?
Yep.
And in particular, you know, let people who are closest to whatever problems they're experiencing design the solution hypotheses and execute on those as well, and not just sort of be handed, you know, here's the most interesting problem and here's how you should solve it.
Yeah.
And I think there are all sorts of gradations in there about sort of distributing decision-making responsibility, but I do think that that's one of the places to start. And then another piece of this is something which, you know, I wouldn't describe myself as having a great depth of knowledge about, but a Harvard organizational psychologist named Chris Zargiris talks about organizational defensiveness.
Yep.
And how we're sort of trained to never tell each other what we really think. Even though there are some corporate environments that are sort of nasty and people go around each other's backs and try to undermine each other, like the average, the thing that happens, I think, much more often is that we are just afraid to have real conflict in organizations. And I think that we're taught from like school on that conflict is bad.
Yeah.
And, we look for the middle ground, or we look to just, you know, avoid having the difficult conversations. And I think that that is also just serving us so incredibly poorly, because the problems we face are so complex, and people should have very different perspectives about them. And we really need to create context in which those different perspectives can, you know, smash into each other if we want to solve these problems. So those are, you know, two very related areas that I think are major challenges for modern management.
Okay. So you were saying that like one of the biggest things is that, so traditionally, basically, there's a couple of people at the head of the company who are doing most of the thinking, and now we're moving into this area where we're kind of hoping that we can harness the brain power of everyone that's working for the company. How do we actually get to that? How do we do that?
So that's a big part of what my work is about. And you know, I'm taking a particular set of approaches right now at Spotify that are, I hope, contextually appropriate to Spotify. So I feel like I'm less able to give generalized answers to that question than I am to talk about sort of our experience right now. And I think, you know, I think a lot about the approaches that we're taking at Spotify probably aren't the exact approaches I would take if I could found, if I decided I wanted to found a company today and build the management structures there that I think might most aggressively address these issues. But, you know, in our context, it's, we are a fairly large company at 1,700 people. We are actually a fairly traditionally hierarchically organized company as well. We have a lead team made up of the C-level executives. We have a bunch of VPs and directors and managers and first-line managers. So, you know, I think in some parts of the organization, it can be as much as maybe five or six levels deep, which is probably, you know, unusually even hierarchical for a company of our size. And we could talk a little bit about why I think we're like that. But so for us, it's about figuring out each level's role in decision making. And what I've really been pushing for, and this is influenced, you know, pretty heavily by a book by Stephen Bungay named The Art, called The Art of Action, and also a book by Pascal Dennis called Getting the Right Things Done, which is based on his experience with Hoshin Kanri, which is the strategy deployment model in the Toyota production system. What we're focused on doing is so, for example, trying over time to help Daniel Ek, our founder and CEO, talk largely about the direction he wants the company to take the world in. Mm-hmm. So not just the direction of the company, but we focus on trying to get him to express a vision of the future that's going to be a better world for not just Spotify, but also creators and consumers of music and related content. And luckily, he is one of these, I think, incredibly rare people who kind of can see around corners. He really does have a vision for what the future should look like. And so that actually has not been that difficult. I think he almost has been looking for the framework in which to express these things. So that's one level. So can we have Daniel and the other members of the lead team talk mostly about the world they want to...
about the vision that they want to achieve through the company.
And then can the sort of next couple of levels work at beginning to codify that into visions for what the world of their particular area might look like in the next 6 months or 12 months or 18 months. And just sort of keep having at each level, keeping that concept of talking mostly about the world we want to design. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we are doing things like identifying, you know, how many MAU we want to have, monthly average users we want to have, mm-hmm. or, you know, what we think our revenue targets will be. But these are less about like setting targets mm-hmm. that you must hit and more about describing the world in some fairly concrete ways.
Okay, so you mentioned that it's that you have a vision and then the people like after that, well, you need to figure out how to actually make that vision come true. And what are your like processes and policies and ways of working to actually get to that? And what often happens with processes and policies, they become really rigid. And when the like environment changes or the world changes around you or the competitors do something, you need to be able to adapt really quickly. And that's, I think, where many of the companies fail. And how do you kind of protect yourself against that the policies and the processes don't become so rigid that you're not able to change them when the world changes?
Yep. So I mentioned before that I could sort of talk about the way that we're addressing these kinds of concerns at Spotify. Mm-hmm. And I think that I just can't stress enough how much there are what I think are just sort of parts of Spotify's DNA that have impacted our ability to take these concepts that aren't that unique, that you know, probably the way that we do strategy deployment isn't If you were to take a 30,000 foot view, isn't that different from the way that a company like Ford, where I've actually talked to the people who do strategy deployment, it's not that different at the 30,000 foot level. But then I think when you dial in on the details, it's different in a lot of very material ways.
Yeah.
I think one of the funny things to me about how people think about Spotify, at least outside of Spotify, is that our special sauce might be this. This organization that we have in our tech product and design group, where we have chapters and tribes and squads that I'm sure most of your listeners have heard about. But that's just actually a traditional matrix model that we give some fancy names to. I think that there are some very special ways about the way we go about living in that model, but there's really nothing particularly unique about it. Yeah. I think to me, what I've discovered over time is that what is really different about Spotify is its incredible drive for continuous improvement.
Yep.
So the ways in which that inculcates in our strategy setting model and deployment model, I think, include the following. So we call that model Spotify Rhythm. And that sort of speaks to the fact that we think of it as a set of cadenced events that happen throughout the course of the year. Or actually, I should say cadenced and just in time. So it's a mix of those things.
Yeah.
And there's a high degree of expectation that we do continuous improvement on the elements of the cadence themselves. So as an example, coming up in about a month is an event called Strategy Days that my team runs. That is an opportunity for about 70 key decision strategic decision makers in the company to get together. We do it twice a year.
Okay.
It's 3 days. And that's really about sort of making sure that that group of people create some connective tissue about agreement about where we're going and why we're trying to go there. Every time we run strategy days, I feel a very strong degree of responsibility to make sure that it's noticeably better than the last one. And then the same is true about the sort of content that flows through the system. So we use what I describe as an argument model called, we call it DIBS, or Data, Insights, Beliefs, and Bets. The expectation is that if you believe that Spotify should do something, you should have gathered data.
Mm-hmm.
You should have extracted some insights from that data. You should have been able to formulate some beliefs about the world. And then you should be able to formulate a bet, which is the thing you'd like to do to test those beliefs. So I think one way in which we're very different from sort of the average deployment of a similar model is that it isn't about one level of the organization saying, go do this and hit these marks. It's about one level. It's about really a negotiation between a couple of levels in the organization, which we're saying, this is what we think the world looks like. If we're right, then if we took the following action, if we made the following bet, we'd expect the following outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
So let's go take that bet and let's see if it produces our expected outcomes, or let's see what else it produces.
Mm-hmm.
A big part of what we do with the cadenced and just-in-time elements is we are being super attentive to what we're learning in the course of a bet and asking ourselves whether we're making the right bets against the beliefs we have or if maybe the beliefs we have are wrong.
Yeah. So basically you're talking about like doing experiments and doing like very like lean startup kind of things, but you're just calling them bets to kind of emphasize the fact that like you might not be right and you might lose money and so on. So that is that the point?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the bet language creeped in about a year ago when way too many of us read John Thiel's book, Zero to One. Peter Thiel's book, Zero to One.
Yeah.
And you can and probably should to object to a lot of things about Peter Thiel.
Yeah.
His sort of framing about thinking about investments as bets really resonated with us. We want people to think about the fact that when a company Spotify size decides to invest in a particular project or initiative,
mm-hmm.
It's pretty expensive. And we have no idea whether it's going to be the right investment or not. And mm-hmm. We use language often to sort of engender the behaviors we hope to see.
Okay, that's really, really impressive. And you mentioned about the like the target setting and the like the expectations that when you do something again, or when you hit a certain part of the cadence again, that there's like expectations for it to be better than the previous time. But you were saying that expectations, it does not come from the management, or like, does it, or where does it come from, the expectation that it needs to be better?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's something I think about a lot at Spotify. I've never personally experienced so much drive as I see expressed by individuals at Spotify, pretty much everyone I encounter.
Yeah.
I like to say that I've met no assholes in my time at Spotify, and I've met a lot of people. So there's this amazing mix of a pretty genuine no asshole culture, and also this incredible drive. I think that's really unique. Something that sort of helped me think about this, I might piss some people off by saying this, but over the last year, I've had an opportunity to do a couple of exchanges with a friend of mine named Arne Rook, who holds a similar job to mine at a company called Jimdo in Hamburg. And I spent a week there, I think last fall, and he spent a couple of weeks with my team at Spotify. And I love Jimdo. I think it's an amazing business, and they've built an incredible company. If I could convince my wife to move to Germany, it's not impossible that I'd want to work there. Yeah. And partially it's because I think in many ways, and I hope the founders aren't bothered by me saying this, but I think in many ways they've built a lifestyle business. Mm-hmm. In some ways, it's very similar to Spotify. In some ways, it is much more, I think, about letting the founders and the employees live a particular kind of lifestyle. Mm-hmm. Spotify, in contrast, is really about winning to a really strong degree.
Okay, yeah.
I said this to Arne when I first visited Jimdo, that this was the biggest difference I saw. And he was like, oh, no, we want to win. And then he came and spent a week at Spotify, and he was like, oh, I see what you mean. And then I've heard him talk about that more recently. And he came and spent a week with me in our office in Stockholm just 2 weeks ago and reiterated it. It really, winning, it inculcates everything that we do. It just so happens that it's balanced by, I think, a desire to be responsible, reasonable human beings.
Yeah, because when I, like, I've met a lot of people from Spotify, and when I think about like winning and Spotify focused on winning, I mean, I kind of get that, but when I think about the term winning, it reminds me of the Jack Welch book, Winning.
Yeah.
And I don't think that that's what Spotify is about.
No, not at all. I think that probably Daniel Ek and the others who sort of inculcated the early days of the culture probably have not read Jack Welch's book, Winning.
Yeah.
I think it goes back to having a vision for a better future and understanding that, and this is something that actually the Peter Thiel talks about that really resonated with me and probably other members of the team at Spotify. He talks about this matrix. I don't remember exactly how it was structured at this point, but he talks about there are optimists and there are pessimists, and there are optimists who say the world's going to be better because I'm going to make it better. And there are optimists who say the world's just going to get better. And then there are pessimists who say the world's going to get worse and there's nothing I can do about it. Yeah. And there are pessimists who say the world's going to get worse and I'm going to take sort of the following defensive positions. Mm-hmm. And I forget his exact language, but I think that Spotify really is at its core optimistic, and it believes that it is going to make the world a better place. It doesn't think the world's just going to be better.
Yeah.
So I think that winning is very much tied into that.
So it's not like a winning like from the point of view that I'm going to take away from others and I want to make sure that I win. It's more like let's all win.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's absolutely true.
And I think that actually when I think about Reactor, I think that's one of the things that I think most people don't really see about Reactor. When they think about Reactor, they kind of see the thing that we like, our employees are very satisfied and like we have a really good culture and so on. But actually, we also have a really strong focus on like profitable business, or actually the business working really well. Because that's, and I think the profitable business and the like the employee satisfaction and those two are so closely linked together. And even though people kind of understand that, it's still like, I think most people would be surprised about like how much we talk about the fact that everything we need to do should be profitable and we should focus on profitable business.
Yeah, that's something I've been thinking about a lot recently. I'm relatively new to running company operations at Spotify, just since May, and it's given me a lot more exposure. Just in the last month, I report to Daniel Ek, our CEO, mm-hmm. and it's given me a lot more exposure to sort of our business model and the thinking mm-hmm. around our business model. And that's territory that a lot of people from the Agile and Lean community haven't spent a lot of time in. And I think frankly have some pretty superficial there's not very sophisticated thinking about. Mm-hmm. There might be a better world in which the profit motive it can be abandoned, mm-hmm. but it can't be in this world. Yeah. And I think that if more people from the kinds of backgrounds that you and I have engage mm-hmm. more closely in those kinds of concerns, I think we'd be more likely to be bringing about a better world. I think that, really at the end of the day for a company like Spotify or like Reactor to have a big impact, they have to be profitable. They need one thing in particular. They need free cash flow.
Yeah, and actually one of the things that that you mentioned about the continuous improvement and how that's like at the very core of Spotify. And I think one of the like at the events that we both participated in Sweden, I think we had, I'm not sure if you were involved in that discussion, but we were kind of trying to think about like there's the concept of a minimum viable product. And that's very well known and so on. But we were thinking like if there's such a concept as a minimum viable company mm-hmm. and like if that existed, what would be the practice or the like processes of that company? And kind of one of the, I think it was Håkan Fors who was kind of like saying that all you need is kind of like just the feedback cycle or mm-hmm. the retrospectives. And I think there's actually quite a lot of truth to that, that there's, it might be that just having a really like really short feedback cycle where you can actually like get stuff done as a result of like the learning, you might actually be able to just with that create a great company. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think that's a really appealing concept. And I guess that generates two strains of thought. One is that I think to some degree, not that I know that much about it, but I think that the company Crisp that Henrik Nyberg works for in many ways is trying to be a minimally viable company. I don't know that, I don't think he was part of that particular conversation, and I don't know that they've ever framed it that way, but when I think about, they've published their working model, they've open sourced their working model.
Yeah, I think it's on GitHub
on GitHub.
Yeah. Company DNA, I think they call it. Yeah.
I think that's in many ways from the conversations I've had with him, sort of in what they've been going for. If you're interested in that idea, I think that's an interesting place to poke around. Yeah. I think the other thing that I actually wanted to make sure to mention is that there actually is a lot of ritual. There are a bunch of artifacts. There's frankly a shit ton of spreadsheets involved in the work that my team is doing right now. Yeah. And my hope is that most of this is scaffolding, mm-hmm. so that we can inculcate some ways of thinking about how to approach problems using some of these artifacts and ritual cadences. And then over time, I think they can disappear. And I think that we will be able to execute on a lot of the underlying goodness mm-hmm. without mm-hmm. having to go through these sort of structured, rigorous processes.
So this kind of takes me back to the things that you were talking about TLC, when you kind of like, you just took in Scrum as like by the book and you kind of didn't understand the underlying things and doing it by the book, you kind of got to that point where you could actually understand the underlying stuff, theories behind it. So do you feel that at Spotify, that's kind of a similar situation? It's just not Scrum. It's not particularly Scrum that you're working on at the moment, but there are things like where you just need the cadence to kind of get into the rhythm of doing things this way, and you'll kind of figure out the background of why that happens and why it's important. You'll kind of figure that later.
I think that's pretty close. I think the analogy is a really good one. I think that there are actually a lot of people, myself, I'd like to think included on my team, who understand the why at Spotify. Yeah. But the reality is that most people don't really access problems through the why. Mm-hmm. They access problems through the how. Mm-hmm. And I think, to me, that's always been sort of one of the shortcomings of some of the people and thinking and thinkers that I admire the most in the Agile and Lean communities, is that, you know, they've reached a point in their career where they've accessed the why.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they are really sold on the idea of not selling the how, but giving people access to the why.
Yeah.
But I think the reality is that people just learn in lots of different ways. And I think the vast majority of people learn through some mix, but mm-hmm. really need exposure to the how first.
And
you know, I don't have any science to back that claim mm-hmm. up, but I do have 20 years of experience.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've found it. I don't know that I've ever seen an example where, like, large groups of people can be exposed to the why and then sort of self-emerge a perfect how.
Yeah, I totally share that experience. And I like seeing that happen in companies that you like starting with the why. I mean, it would be good to understand it, but I think that it's most often it's just so much easier to get started with the how. And once you got like, when you get the hang of the how, it's easier to understand the why. And that, I think that happens a lot in organizations. And when I've started seeing that, I've kind of also realized about like my personal learning style, that instead of just always trying to figure out like, why is this important and why do I need to do this? I just like, it's often easier to just get started and just do something.
Yep.
And after doing it for a while, you kind of figure out that, okay, now I understand why this is important and why we need to do this. And
yeah.
So on.
I mean, doing is the root of learning, right?
Yeah.
Like, I think there are, learning researchers and theorists who will say that there actually is no learning that doesn't emerge through doing. So
yeah.
I think that makes perfect sense to me.
Yeah.
Again, though, I do think that, you know, being successful with moving from the how to the why depends on being in a culture where you don't just sort of adopt the how and then just do that forever, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And to sort of tie a bow around where this conversation started, I think the pressure for continuous improvement comes mm-hmm. from the drive to win.
Yeah. Yeah.
And is sort of educated by what I have to assume is, at least to some degree, Daniel, I think also Oscar Stahl, our CTO, their belief that the fastest, best path to winning is mm-hmm. through learning and through, yeah. therefore through continuous improvement.
Yeah.
Lots of other people would take a very different approach to winning. Like, the best approach to winning is by killing your enemies, right? Like,
that's not
our culture.
Yeah. Okay. I still want to talk about the hierarchy that you mentioned, that you guys have a lot of hierarchy. And I think one of the big things at the moment is like, or there's definitely like a move towards companies that don't have hierarchy. And what kind of always bugs me about that conversation is the fact that like hierarchy in itself is not like, it's not a bad or a good thing. And I've actually always used Spotify as an example of a company that like has hierarchy. I know that you guys have a lot of hierarchy, and it doesn't seem to be a problem at Spotify. I mean, the people that I meet at Spotify, they're not bothered by it. And they don't like, it seems that you guys kind of don't get the bad side effects of a hierarchy. Of course, I'm not like, I don't work for Spotify. I don't see all the internals, but I think that's really, really interesting that you guys are kind of showing a way to be like a hierarchical company that still like operates like it's not so completely dysfunctional as you normally see hierarchical companies to be.
Yeah. So, you and I have talked in the past about the fact that any model has its pros and cons. And then I think any model also has the potential of going to one extreme or the other. So, you know, I have friends at a Holacracy
mm-hmm.
That unfortunately just went through some very, very difficult times and then shut down.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that friend told me that things got very, very bad. Her conclusion, at least in the moment, was that Holacracy just couldn't survive. the difficult times they were facing. On the flip side, I think that there are very hierarchical organizations that are horrible for reasons that probably go way beyond hierarchy, but the mm-hmm. hierarchical structure is a manifestation of that horror, basically. So Spotify is a very hierarchical organization that I think that has a number of things, probably not least of which are its Swedishness, mm-hmm. that make the hierarchy less of a concern. But we certainly have many of the same problems of a traditional hierarchy.
Yeah.
We have real issues with information flow. Mm-hmm. We are overly siloed. We have chosen in many, many ways, a very sort of, componentized, compartmentalized organization. Mm-hmm. And it reflects not just our org structure, but even our software, mm-hmm. Not that surprisingly, in ways that are not ideal. But I think that what Spotify doesn't have is this assumption that this division between the thinkers and the doers. Mm-hmm. And if you think about, like, how could that even really survive in a modern knowledge work company? And you hear about, you know, the stuff that has been said about Amazon, which I have no idea I have no idea what's actually happening in Amazon.
Yeah,
But if you think about, I am really curious. Amazon has built some of my favorite products. I think they have made some of the most interesting innovations in recent history. And I'm really hopeful that they're not as bad as the New York Times article said they are.
Me too, yeah.
And I'm really curious about how they could be and still manage to produce these interesting things. Because I don't really see how that's possible. I think that, you know, we hire, you know, in my early days at Spotify, I went through this experience of just meeting like 24-year-old after 24-year-old just out of school who's like, clearly 10,000 times smarter than I am. And like many of whom are clearly going to go on and found amazing companies that I hope to work for them someday. They're never going to accept being the worker bees and like having all the decisions made somewhere else. It just doesn't make any sense for them. So I think that the main thing that we lack that maybe the worst hierarchy does is this assumption that there are people who do the thinking and people who do the working, and that we're just not. That just doesn't exist for us.
Yeah, wow, that's actually pretty profound. And it actually leads us to the topic of decision making. Like, how does decisions get made at Spotify?
Yep. So I would say that it's really mixed. I think in general, you know, we want decisions to be made as close to the decision space or the problem space as possible. Mm-hmm. And I think we are usually pretty good about that. I do think that one of the interesting things happening culturally at Spotify is that we are largely a consensus-based mm-hmm. Organization. And that means that you know, a lot of people whose lives are going to be touched by a particular problem or a particular solution hypothesis get to have a say in how we understand the problem and then what we think we're going to do about it. Mm-hmm. And that it can be costly and time consuming. That doesn't worry me so much as when you reach sort of analysis paralysis, or when a group of people at a particular tier in the organization can't come to a conclusion together. It does tend to push decision making up the organization, mm-hmm. And then everybody can get more used to decisions needing to flow upwards. So if there's one thing about decision making at Spotify that I'm trying to work on changing, it is, can we get more attuned to the failure modes that result in decision making getting pushed up in the organization? I don't think that, you know, some of the people who I think end up making maybe more decisions than they even want to, mm-hmm. Daniel Ek, our CEO, Gustav Soderstrom, our chief product officer, I think that they would love to see more decision making happening mm-hmm. a level or two below them, And we need to sort of deal with this, what I think it is growing out of this consensus decision-making model in order to address that. I'd really like to see us move towards what I actually have for a while called consent decision-making, and then I discovered that that's sort of a formal thing in the sociocracy model.
Yeah.
And that what I had sort of imagined is not that different from that, which is essentially let's decide who's best suited to make this decision and let them make that decision.
Yeah.
And then the rest of us will object only if we think that taking the action they prescribe is likely to do real damage.
Yeah. Yeah, but the stance is always like move forward.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I really like that. Yeah.
I want to say really quickly that I'm sharing a lot of views today. There are some people at Spotify who would agree with my with some of my analysis, and lots who wouldn't. A thing that interests me is, you know, as Spotify has done a really great job at sort of positioning ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Really, frankly, as an agile employer, right? Like a lot of what we've done externally is employee branding. It means that people pay a lot of attention to the things that we say.
Yeah.
And then I feel a real obligation to point out that I probably don't know what the hell I'm talking about. And that there are lots of very smart people who probably disagree with almost everything I'm saying.
And
you should go talk to them too.
Yeah. So, actually, we kind of touched on the topic of conflicts. Do you have a lot of conflict inside the company?
We don't have as much conflict as I think we should have, not by a long shot. Having said that, I think you're touching on all of my favorite topics. Having said that, I do think there's an interesting thing about my experience at Spotify. I've heard others with similar experiences. It's not a conflict company necessarily, but it is a challenging company. So. More than anywhere else I've ever worked at, if I say something, and it, particularly like, so to go back to the data insights beliefs bets framework, I think why that's so good for Spotify is that we like to have conversations like, I'll say, here's some really interesting data.
Mm-hmm.
And someone else will say like, no, that's not interesting. Yeah, that's the wrong data.
Yeah.
Or I'll say, here's some great insights I've gleaned from this data. And someone else will say, no, your insights are all wrong. It's the right data, but this is what that data says.
Okay, yeah.
And then I'll say, I've come up with these great beliefs based on these insights that I've gotten from this data. And someone else will be like, those beliefs are completely wrong.
Yeah,
these are the beliefs you should have based on those insights and that data. And I think that people really do challenge each other's thinking.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there are, though, classes of activities where we are not challenging enough to each other. I think that we do have organizational dysfunction that everyone knows about and no one's really talking about.
Okay.
But I think particularly as far as the, like, the subject matter of work goes, we are very challenging of each other. And it is really intimidating.
Mm-hmm.
We talk a lot internally about imposter syndrome. Everyone has imposter syndrome at Spotify.
Yeah, it's actually exactly the same thing at Reactor. We've been talking about it a lot. Yeah,
yep.
Yeah.
Even though Spotify, I think, is a very friendly and very caring place, it's very, in my opinion, it can be a very hard place to work.
Yeah,
because you will be challenged all the time.
One thing you also mentioned is the like the Swedishness, and Spotify is a like it was founded in Sweden, and now also working in this in the States. So can you talk a little about the differences between the Nordic working culture and the U.S. working culture?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that. The Swedes in general are much more careful about work-life balance. It's really striking.
Yeah.
In ways that I think are interesting, I think that one of the many acts of genius that I call them our Swedish overlords. One of their many acts of genius, I think, was by opening an office in the U.S., which I think actually sometimes we pick up the slack. So where their work-life balance is quite solid, I think ours is actually worse, in part because of it. So, you know, I think that's an interesting dynamic. I would say, though, certainly that that work-life balance aspect has crept into life in the U.S., in the U.S. Spotify offices. I think that I think Spotify is a very fair company. I think it is a meritocracy. And I think that the consensus, the sort of everyone gets a say, I think those are all, you know, in my mind, probably a little bit more Swedish than they are American. A coworker who was until very recently my boss, our CTO, you know, he'll sometimes say to me, like, he just yesterday sent me an email that was like, I was complaining to him about some situation. He was like, well, your American head is interpreting it this way, and my Swedish head is interpreting it this way. And like, my American head was like, this person's trying to fuck with me. And his head was like all about like trying to understand the motives. And like, I often have talked about Spotify being like sweet American, like, it really is a mix. And I think that Swedish is obviously Sweden is obviously a very entrepreneurial country. Many of the most interesting startups are Swedish. I think the same is true more broadly of the Nordics. Also, I read recently that there are more billionaires per 100 people in Sweden than any other country in the world.
Really? Wow.
And I just recently spent 3 weeks there, and I have never seen so many supercars as I saw on the streets of Stockholm. More Lamborghinis, Maseratis, Lotuses than I've ever seen in L.A. or Miami or anywhere else. So, you know, they're maybe more American than they let on.
Okay. So, closing off, what are you currently interested in, or what are you kind of like looking into? Like, if people want to like get inside your head, or the things that you're kind of thinking about now, what should they read or listen to or look into?
That's really interesting. So I came off a period. So when I was at TLC, and maybe this was Jabe's or Will's influence, I spent a lot of time reading and learning about new theory in my time at TLC. That's diminished a lot in my time at Spotify. In the little tiny bit of free time I have between having three kids and my work, and trying to be a musician on the side, I'm actually like way more interested in culture right now. I've always been, but I it's interesting to say this on a podcast. I'm always been really fascinated with the film and music industries, and I've gotten really into a number of podcasts that are largely focused on like creative people and their experiences and how they work. So Mark Maron's podcast that I mentioned earlier, but also Brian Koppelman has a podcast called The Moment, which sort of gets into what he calls inflection points, like big momentous experiences in the lives of creative people. I've been much more into that stuff recently. Yeah. Like how does creativity really happen? You know, I've gotten back into reading books about some of like my rock and roll heroes, I'd stopped reading for a long time. So, you know, I've recently read like a Motley Crue biography and a Grateful Dead biography. You know, and we talked about the how and the why, and it's like, you know, most of the most creative people in the world have not spent a single second thinking about complexity theory or systems thinking.
No, don't say that.
I'm afraid it's true. But the great artists are not spending their time in those things. And yet they're producing, you know, amazing stuff. So that's sort of where my head has been at recently.
Actually, this reminds me, like, way back when we met at that Kanban event. One of the things that I remember, you were kind of like wreaking havoc among the Kanban community, because you guys were discussing the fact that you should, instead of like getting stuff through the through the board as quick as possible. You should kind of like get stuff to drop off the board as quick as possible, meaning that you guys should kind of get the experiments done and like figure out what's not working and not finish them if you kind of figure out that it's not working.
Yeah.
So that's kind of like, to me, it sounds like it's you're still focused on this on like similar things, but it's kind of turning more into like, instead of like focusing on like getting stuff done or like how do you get experiments done quickly and learn quickly, it's all about like creativity and like how do you actually like what makes you creative and how can you be more creative. Is that, am I getting you right?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I think that I feel a real obligation to those 24-year-old MIT graduates to help create an environment where they can do awesome stuff.
Yeah.
That's an obligation that runs not just to them, but then also to our Daniel's ideas and the people who helped build Spotify's ideas about what the world can look like. I mean, yeah. when they started Spotify, like, the music industry was really going to die. Mm-hmm. And that's not about like the labels dying or the radio stations dying, although those things mm-hmm. were happening and to some degree still are. It was about like, it wasn't going to be possible to get paid to make art.
Yeah.
And I think that as much as this is, I think it makes me pretty sad, actually. I think this is deeply misunderstood in the press. Mm-hmm. But that is why Daniel started Spotify, to make it possible for people to get paid to make art, mm-hmm. because probably there won't be that much great art made if you can't get paid.
Yeah, yeah.
Which maybe it's sad that that's the way it is, but it is the way it is.
Yeah.
And I think that Spotify has really actually very much helped start to address this problem. And you know, there's a J curve, as there is with anything else. Things mm-hmm. probably were going to get worse before they got better. I think that we see a lot of green shoots now. We see markets mm-hmm. in which revenue from all sorts of different sources for creators are starting to grow.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the first time since long before Spotify came along. It's really the first time since Napster that you can see global revenue growing for creatives.
Yeah.
And we definitely think we've contributed to that, and we want to continue doing that. So, yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head. I'm way more interested in creating context for creativity than I am in sort of optimizing throughput.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you. Thanks for a really nice chat.
Awesome. Thank you for the opportunity.
So that's it. If you want to read more on the stuff we talked about, you can find links in the show notes. I would really appreciate your thoughts on this first episode. Tweet, comment on Facebook, or send an email to hello@bosslevelpodcast.com. If you like the podcast, a positive review on iTunes would be nice. I think now would be a good time to give thanks to the amazing people who helped this podcast come to life. Of course, thank you Simon Marcus for daring to do the first episode with me. Thank you Timo Londen for the graphic design for the podcast. Thanks Jari Arniola from Embreach for the theme song. Thank you everyone on Facebook who helped pick out a name for the podcast. And I think it was Ville Valtonen who suggested Boss Level, so thank you, Ville. Thanks to Antti and Jarkko at the Tyyppimuunnos podcast. Your episode on how you run your podcast saved me a lot of Googling and researching. And thanks to my wife, Mervi, for the support and for letting me record this stuff on a Sunday afternoon. For the upcoming episode, I reached out to a bunch of amazing people for interviews, and so far, they've all said yes. So this podcast is gonna be awesome. I'm going to be talking to CEOs, complexity theorists, and lean experts on how to reach boss level. The next episode will be released in 2 weeks. To make sure you don't miss it, subscribe to the podcast, like it on Facebook, and follow it on Twitter. And don't forget to share it with friends. And enemies. Yes, also share it with your enemies. Tune in again in 2 weeks for the next episode of the Boss Level Podcast.